from New York City. This is Film Spotting, streaming video units. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer, and I can't think of an intro joke that would possibly be appropriate for this episode's review of 13th, Ava DuVernay's documentary about mass incarceration and America's history of racial injustice. But, you know, maybe...
Let's not.
What about...
Definitely not. Later in the episode, in our Cue Shot segment, we'll be recommending some other documentaries from filmmakers who, like DuVernay, are better known for their scripted work. All of these titles available to rent or stream at home right now. But before then, we've got Opening Break, a segment done in conjunction with Movies on Demand on cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films that are new on demand. Matt, you're up this time. What have you got for us?
What about...
No.
Oh, okay. Just thought it might be worth one last shot. My first pick for Opening Break this time is available now. It is the new film from the filmmaker Ty West. It is called In a Valley of Violence, and I believe it's his first Western. This is a revenge Western, as the plot synopsis goes, set in the 1890s, where a man played by Ethan Hawke arrives in a small town seeking vengeance for his murdered friend. And it stars Ethan Hawke and John Travolta. They are the stars of the film. And I pulled this paragraph from the New York Times review of the movie, which I have not seen. But this paragraph, the first paragraph, caught my eye. The most satisfying relationship in Ty West's Western homage, In a Valley of Violence, is between Ethan Hawke and a scene-stealing collie mix whose movie name is Abby. As Keanu Reeves did a couple of years ago in John Wick, Mr. Hawke plays a newly reluctant killer who's forced to exact revenge on a passel of villains who dared mess with his canine companion. As far as movies go, it seems that dogs are the new wives. And so you tell me that the guy who made The House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, two films I like very much, made basically John Wick in the Old West with Ethan Hawke and John Travolta. I'm interested.
Sure.
That was the best selling of that movie that I've seen so far. I haven't seen that mentioned. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's considered a spoiler to some, but I haven't seen that sort of, you know, pitch, that elevator pitch on any of the descriptions of the movie.
And it makes it sound a lot more fun than the impression I had gotten of it.
Right. That, me too. Was. Yes. Yes. I had no idea it was so John Wick-y.
Yes.
Well,
I'm sold.
And I imagine that me telling people has sold some other people on it as well. So that is called In a Valley of Violence. It is available now on VOD. Two more quick picks here. Our first one is called Our Kind of Traitor, directed by Susanna White. It's also available now on VOD. The plot description I have here says, a couple finds themselves lured into a Russian oligarch's plans to defect and are soon positioned between the Russian mafia and the British Secret Service, neither of whom they can trust. Sounds just like my honeymoon. It's so funny. The cast is Ewan McGregor, Stellan Skarsgård, and Naomi Harris. And the selling point here for me, besides the cast, which is good, is that it is based on a novel by John le Carré, whose work tends to inspire very good movies. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, The Constant Gardener, A Most Wanted Man, The Tailor of Panama. I'm not going to tell you, I haven't seen this movie, but I'm not going to tell you that this movie is on par with those films. But to me, it's like when I see, oh, there's a new movie based on, now granted, I think I've read one John le Carré novel, but you know, when I see his, he seems to lend himself to very good, very dark, very depressing,
melancholy
espionage, yes, thriller. So that's why, to me, when I saw, oh, a new John le Carré novel movie, I'm interested. That is Our Kind of Traitor, and that is available now on VOD. And finally, also available now on VOD, from a filmmaker I'm very surprised to see his name on this movie. I did not realize this, even though I was familiar with the film. The film is USS Indianapolis: Men of Courage. Do you know who directed this film, Allison?
I do not.
Mario Van Peebles.
Really?
Yes, who apparently, as I looked on his IMDb page after I learned that, does a lot of TV directing these days. Of course, you know, started as an actor, his father is a filmmaker. But he does a lot of TV these days. He directs Empire, he directed Nashville, Chicago PD, a lot of stuff. That's his main gig. But he did direct this movie. You're aware of it, I assume.
I have seen the poster.
You've seen the poster, okay.
It's hard to forget.
I have seen the trailer as well. The plot description is... the harrowing true story of the crew of the USS Indianapolis, who were stranded in the Philippine Sea for 5 days after delivering the atomic weapons that would eventually end World War II. As they awaited rescue, they endured extreme thirst, hunger, and, wait for it, relentless shark attacks. Now, if that sounds vaguely familiar, there's a reason for that. Allison, do you know why that might sound familiar to a movie buff who's not necessarily a history buff? That is the story that Quint tells in the movie Jaws.
Wow.
So this is a adaptation of the real story of the USS Indianapolis. It's apparently a true story, this ship that was sort of wrecked and then attacked by sharks. And here's the real kicker. The cast includes Tom Sizemore, Thomas Jane, James Remar, and...
Nicolas Cage.
So to recap, Nicolas Cage in a war film based-ish or inspired by the same story as the story that Quint tells in Jaws, directed by Mario Van Peebles.
I can't believe you haven't seen this already.
It is a little surprising I haven't seen it.
I will say, I even if you never see this, I recommend the poster in which they've done something slightly weird to Nicolas Cage's face. It's like it's of the floating, you know, kind of busts approach.
Yeah, to sort of like Pearl Harbor, which I'm sure they want to sort
but
of evoke.
Like for whatever reason, like Nicolas Cage looks kind of orange and the expression on his face is just a little odd, as it often is when Nicolas Cage is captured.
As we're recording here live, let me see if I can look at this poster in real time. Hold on. It's just his face? That's the one I want to see?
Well, there's two. There's one with the array of other stars behind him.
Which one do I want to look at?
I feel like the one with the array.
Okay, let me find the array. Hold on. The one I found first has just him looking very solemnly over his shoulder.
That's also a pretty good one.
That's good, but not as good.
No, the array
is
better.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's got sort of a pout.
Yeah. It just, it almost doesn't look like him.
No, it doesn't. You can't see his hair. He's wearing
a
hat.
And he's orange. He's very orange.
He is a little
almost a little Trumpian.
Yes, there's a slightly...
In the expression.
Yes, the sort of downturned frown.
Yes.
I see it. I see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
It's a lot to think about, is what we're saying.
I'm going to be thinking about this. I'm going to have nightmares about this poster. But I'm going to watch the movie, which again is called USS Indianapolis : Men of Courage. And that is also available now on VOD.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of black criminality.
Here on Film Spotting SVU, we let you, the listeners, choose our main review by voting on one of three options. And we put together a kind of motley selection of movies for our last poll. One doc, Ava DuVernay's Netflix original 13th. One older movie, the Stephen King adaptation Misery on Amazon Prime. And one recent fiction film, Jacques Audiard's 2015 Palme d'Or winner Dipan. 13th leapt into the front of the pack early on and never let that lead go, winning with 42% of the vote. 13th is the fifth film from Ava DuVernay, who actually got her start in nonfiction with the 2008 doc This Is the Life, about the Good Life Cafe in LA, and it's how its open mic nights became central to the alternative hip-hop scene of the 90s. She quickly moved on to scripted films with indies I Will Follow and Middle of Nowhere, both streaming on Netflix right now, laying groundwork for her to make Selma, her acclaimed 2014 historical drama that was nominated for the Oscar for Best Picture. 13th is, in that light, a bit of an unconventional in-between move for a filmmaker whose career has been seriously on the rise and who's currently working on an adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time for Disney. It was a surprise project, filmed secretly and unveiled only when it was announced as the opening night film of the recently concluded New York Film Festival. But the 13th is very in line with both DuVernay's vocal political views and her career-long interest in mass incarceration here in the U.S., where, in the oft-cited fact brought up at the start of the 13th, we have 5% of the world's population, but are home to 25% of the world's prison population. Now, 13th covers a lot of ground. It starts with the Civil War, the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery with a stipulation that, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. And from there, it goes through the civil rights movement about how activism and counterculture were criminalized and presented in political rhetoric as destabilizing forces, about dog whistle politics, about the explosive growth in the prison population, the war on drugs, three strikes, private prisons, and how they have come to influence legislature on behalf of their own interests, and into the present day and Black Lives Matter. And I'm sure I've missed a lot of things in between there. And it pulls in an array of talking heads, activists and historians and journalists and academics like Angela Davis, Henry Louis Gates, Michelle Alexander, though its standout interview may be Newt Gingrich, mainly because he admits, long after huge damage was done, we absolutely should have treated crack and cocaine as the same thing.
Yeah.
I think it was an enormous burden on the Black community, but it also fundamentally violated a sense of core fairness. So, Matt, I don't think there is any denying the importance or the urgency of DuVernay's subject matter here. Mm-hmm. She's attempting to deliver no less than a sweeping historical thesis on racial injustice in the country. But do you think 13th works as a film? Or is it a film in this case mainly as a container for something more pragmatic?
Yes, that is the question, isn't it? The Wilson, did we ever, the Wilmore, did we ever name your theory of filmmaking? We really should codify it. Just your argument.
My big question of.
Yes. The Wilmore corollary of documentary filmmaking. Is this a good movie?
Right.
Even if you agree with it, even if you admire the content and the aim. Yes, is it a good film? I have to say, in this case, while I learned some stuff from this movie, I wasn't upset that I saw it. I think Ava DuVernay is a fabulous filmmaker in general, and I think I'm very excited that she sort of is having a sort of exciting rise in her career. I want to see her make a big Hollywood movie, and I want her to keep making whatever she wants. I didn't really know if this was a great movie. It felt a bit like a mess to me. Like, it is, how did you put it? A container for however you described it? That's exactly sort of what I felt. I felt that there was a lot of digressions and, you know, it almost, it's kind of the movie version of like when someone makes the crazy wall, the yarn wall with all the connections, only this is more lucid and more urgent and certainly not a conspiracy or anything like that. But just the way it's just kind of rambling through history and this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And all of these things are important. And there are some things that I didn't know anything about that I felt I was very glad to learn about. Some of like the lobbying that goes on in terms of the writing of bills.
ALEC.
Yeah, ALEC.
American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah. Right. This sort of, as it's portrayed here, sort of this insidious kind of shadow chamber that works with people in government to basically write legislation that is beneficial to the corporations that are members of the group, essentially. It's a lobbying group, and there's lots of lobbying groups, and they're not, I don't think all lobbying is necessarily bad, but when you see it depicted in this movie and what the things that they're trying to pass, that's a very troubling sequence.
Yeah, I can't figure out a way to defend that.
Right.
But I mean, you want to.
If there is a central thesis of this movie, I don't know that it necessarily fits in with it as it is stated in the beginning of the film. So, you know, like I said, I wasn't bored, and I learned some stuff from it. I didn't think it was a great movie. It does not pass the Wilmore corollary necessarily, or it gets a barely passing grade. It does not pass with flying colors.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there is a lot of very worthy material here, and there were a dozen times where a topic would be brought up, and I felt like
this is a movie,
yeah. especially the ALEC part, which was for me the part that I knew least about, and is just, I think, in itself speaks to so many problems in the ways in which our government operates.
Right,
you know, I think that there were so many times where I just wanted to be like, stop, slow down, focus on this. Yeah. In some ways, as a movie, it feels like. Like the introductory lecture to a semester, you know,
yes.
And that in which you get all of these topics brought up and you keep waiting for them to be filled out in some way. But this isn't a miniseries and it's not a college like semester course. It's one film. Yeah. And I do feel like it reaches so wide in its embrace. And while I understand the desire to draw that through line to be like, like, we did not just arrive at Black Lives Matter. We did not just arrive at, like, having prison populations that are
so
high.
It's no accident. This has been something that's been building up.
And I appreciate her desire for that. But she also, she does, like, I think there's so much in there that she finds urgent and that needs to cram in that it feels overstuffed.
Yeah,
and yet at the
it ends
same
up
time
blunting the impact a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah, I had in my notes, too, the idea that it does feel kind of like a lecture or like a term paper that's sort of an overarching history of, like, race and imprisonment. And it doesn't quite feel like a film or a documentary. And, I mean, one of the things that I loved so much about Selma was not, you know, it obviously had a lot of the same issues it was involved with, but it was a story and it was a portrait of a person. And, you know, there aren't really any characters here. There's talking heads and there's issues, but there's not really a story. There's not really any characters that you can really latch on to and follow through the film. I mean, there again, occasionally someone tells their own personal story and some of those are very interesting as well. And you might think, this person, this activist, their struggles, they could have been a movie as well, but that's not what Ava DuVernay decided to make, and it is a little frustrating at times.
It made me think of An Inconvenient Truth at times, in that where you're like, there is almost nothing about this that necessarily demands a cinematic approach. It is this entirely practical delivery of information.
Yeah.
For the most part, I do think there are moments in which it does spark to life beyond that. I think particularly the clip from it that has gone viral, like, that she has protested herself or, like, being lifted without context, but in which she returns to footage of someone from the civil rights era, this man getting, like, harassed and hit and beaten by white men who dislike what he represents. And that's cut against Donald Trump's
supporters, or
his words at a rally where he is talking about throwing someone out and encouraging them and saying, in the good old days, in the good old days, we wouldn't.
And that's how it was sort of, if you saw it on social media, if this sounds familiar, that was sort of like the text that was accompanying a lot. Because I saw multiple people sort of, it seemed to go, definitely went way viral.
It went huge. And you understand it. It is very powerful.
It's a very powerful.
And it's one of those moments in the movie where it just seems so, it does seem vital, and it does, like, the power of those visuals and the ways in which she draws a connection between history and the present day do seem very worthy. What was interesting about that clip is also that it was, like, first posted by someone who I think worked for the DNC, and she vocally was like, you took this out of context and you didn't attribute it, and, like, if you want to watch this movie, watch the whole thing, which is also not gentle on Hillary Clinton.
No.
With that clip of her super predators speech.
That's right.
It definitely does not excuse her from the 90s and the kind of approach to law and order that happened then.
That said, I did later see, I think, the movie's official account then later retweeted it or put it up themselves.
Right.
So they softened, I guess, somewhat about when they realized the power of that sequence and how viral it was getting.
Right.
And they wanted to get people to realize that this isn't just something someone made as a clip. It is part of this movie, which you could watch on Netflix.
Right. I think she was just mostly upset that it was being leveraged by Democratic.
Sure. You know, being used as sort of messaging. Political propaganda.
Yeah. But
without her consent.
But it is very powerful.
Yeah. And one thing I did want to say that I also thought of while watching this was, you know, like, kudos to, like, Netflix for making this. Like, this isn't necessarily, I mean, who knows? Maybe they have algorithms, their secret algorithms that tell them people want to watch a documentary about the history of race and imprisonment in America. I have no idea. But it doesn't sound on its surface or in its content, like the kind of thing I would necessarily expect from Netflix. Again, we were talking about one of the most incendiary parts of it is the stuff about corporations working against, you know, the public's interests, potentially. And Netflix is a gigantic corporation, and I guess I would assume they're not involved in ALEC, but that doesn't mean that they don't have their own lobbying issues that they, you know, might be interested in. So I give them credit for putting some money into making something like this and putting it in front of lots of people at a time when it is incredibly relevant. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff on Netflix. And to be honest, I don't know that they necessarily, you know, like sold it as well, just from looking at their website compared to some of the placement that some of their original content gets. This did not get exactly the amount of sort of like when you open Netflix.com. I don't remember ever seeing the 13th show up on the homepage the way.
I've gotten more about Haters Back Off, the original series based on a YouTube character.
Yes, I was trying to think of one 13th. That would apply. That's a perfect example. So I can't say that they've really like leveraged it that hard. At least, who knows? Maybe that's something that has to do with me. I don't know. They're personalizing my homepage. Maybe they don't think I want to watch it. I don't know. But it doesn't seem like they really pushed it as hard as some of the other things they release. Nonetheless, I think it's great that it exists in a form that is very easily accessible for millions of people. And you have to imagine if this movie had gotten a sort of like a limited theatrical release, you know, it might have gotten more reviews and more critical acclaim, but it's hard to imagine more people seeing it. And I think if Ava DuVernay's point was, let's get this out there in the world, let's get people to see it, let's make it available, I'm not sure she could have done a much better job of it than she did here.
Sure, I agree. Though I do think that they... And I'm not entirely caught up on the rules of this, but I do think that they probably are counting on this being a very good, if it's eligible,
an Oscar movie,
Oscar contender for a documentary.
Yeah, I guess.
I've seen some people describe it that way as like, this will win the best doc, which they make. Netflix has made forays at every once in a while.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah. It's going to be a very competitive year for best documentary. I guess they couldn't know that when they financed it. But,
I haven't seen it.
Did it even get a theatrical release? I guess it must have if they're going to try to make it have a run for the Oscars. But I haven't seen a lot about that.
I don't think it did get a theatrical release, but it played at a film festival that might have qualified.
Qualifies it enough.
Might have. Yeah, gotcha. I'm not entirely caught up on the rules. I don't know if that's true, but I've seen enough people mention it in the context of Oscars that I'm assuming there might be some basis to that. Either way, I agree. It's going to be a very competitive year. But, I mean... there has never been, I think, a movie that has had a more like relevant argument with regards in particular to like how the Oscars are like feeling about highlighting something, you know, something this like timely, and this relevant in terms of our discussions of race. Mm-hmm. So who's to say?
One other aspect I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned it in your intro actually, which is the fact that it was sort of made kind of in secret and they sort of like, ta-da, like unveiled it as a big surprise when it was announced as the opening night film for the New York Film Festival. And that seems to be something that's kind of happening a lot, not just with movies, music videos.
The surprise drop.
What do you make of that, like as a phenomenon in our culture these days?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny because the person who did it most recently is Michael Moore, who released his Michael Moore in Trumpland documentary that no one knew he was making.
Right.
His second documentary this year, I believe. Did the other one come out this year or last year?
Last year.
His second documentary in a relatively short amount of time for him. And... he just unveiled it and was like,
He tweeted out a picture of him in the editing room, basically like, hey, we're going to show our movie tomorrow for free at the IFC Center. Come on out. I mean, it worked on me. I went and showed up. I got a ticket from the publicist and went to see it.
Yeah, I did not.
I didn't like it very much, but I went.
I find it a really funny contrast to a lot of blockbuster marketing, which has been around basically being like, we know this movie is happening like 4 years from now.
Yeah.
And like, first you'll get this image or like we'll get casting info and then an image and then
poster,
like a teaser. Like interviews all the way along and all of that until when the movie finally arrives, actually watching it seems like beside the point.
Right.
I feel like it is a counter to that. It is the... guess what I made? Come see it now.
Right.
You know? And like, not everyone is Beyonce. In fact, no one is Beyonce except for Beyonce. And I don't think that most people can pull off the kind of excitements and the kind of have the loyalty, the fan base and the loyalty. Certainly not in the film world. But I think as like a personal project kind of thing, or like something, this is clearly of personal interest to Ava DuVernay, regardless of how much or how little she's put of herself in it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It seems like a mark of this being meaningful and almost not needing.
Yeah, I think it does show. One, I think it's very interesting to see it's a very clear example of the power of social media, because you can literally tweet, I made something. And if you have a big enough following and you're important enough, that's all the marketing you need.
Yeah.
right, to sell albums or to get tickets. I mean, the line for Michael Moore's movie on that first night was around the block, and there were hundreds.
And when has that happened?
And I was
going to
say,
him?
When was the last time Michael Moore, I mean, certainly a hugely influential name in political documentaries, but when was the last time there were people lining around the block for a Michael Moore movie?
I mean, his last movie did not perform well.
Right.
And I think it was in part just because he does not have that sense of relevance attached to him.
Right.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it worked.
I mean, you, and, but one of the other things I think you talked about comparing that to the way blockbusters are marketed, I think it's very interesting in comparison to the way that TV is discussed, which is, and blockbusters too, this teaser culture that is so, you know, like watching Westworld and thinking about the theories and watching Marvel movies and going, well, what does this post-credit scene mean for the next Thor movie? The way in which that there is this audience for constantly thinking about things and anticipating things. And in some ways that's most of or all of the fun in a lot of cases is just the anticipation of the thing. So it's interesting that at the same time that has become such a prevalent force in popular culture that now some people are bucking that and doing the exact opposite and being like, whoop, I made a movie. I don't know. I just think it's interesting. I don't have much more to say about it than that, but I do find it fascinating that in the midst of this blockbuster marketing and this teaser culture, we do seem to be having this increasing interest in surprising people with movies.
I like it.
It's
I'm
fun.
Into it.
I mean, it was exciting to be at the theater where Michael Moore premiered his thing, and it was exciting when you read the news, wow, Ava DuVernay has a documentary and it's opening in a couple of weeks. I mean, that's really cool. I didn't entirely love her movie, and I didn't particularly like Michael Moore's movie, but I mean I like the intent with the surprises.
I do too, and I'm happy 13th exists.
I absolutely,
yeah. So that is 13th. You can find it on Netflix.
So our subject, because Ava DuVernay, although you mentioned had made a documentary before, really, you know, her claim to fame is as a fiction filmmaker. So we thought, that's an interesting idea. Fiction filmmakers who venture into the world of documentaries. You know, usually when we do subjects like this, you can do some research online, find lists, at least to start your own personal research. I couldn't find one list. We may have stumbled on the only list that has never been written in the world of film blogging and journalism.
I found some lists that were about people who do both.
Okay.
And that.
Right, but that wasn't quite what we wanted.
It wasn't quite what we were looking for.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of documentarians who then are eventually like, let's give this a try. And
right, like, I mean, there are filmmakers like
work out.
Werner Herzog, who I think does both. And these days he does more documentaries, but I mean, he certainly got his start as a fiction filmmaker. And I guess if we had done this podcast before podcasts existed in like 1998 or something, when he had just started doing more documentaries, he would have fit. But at this point, I think he's almost more of a documentarian than he is a fiction filmmaker. He makes a documentary a year. He makes a fiction film every 5 years, maybe. So... But there are some that sort of straddle that line. James Marsh is another guy I think of who makes documentaries but also makes fiction films.
Didn't Steve James make a scripted film?
Yeah, he has,
sure.
I mean, Michael Moore made a scripted film. Joe Berlinger made the sequel to the original Blair Witch sequel. Yeah, Book of Shadows.
Yeah, no, Michael Moore made that.
Canadian Bacon was the Michael Moore fiction film.
Yeah, I do think when I think of people who cross over, I tend to think more of documentarians who have built up a career and then are like... let's give this a try.
Right.
And it doesn't always work out. But that
doesn't
Barbara
seem to work.
Koppel, I think, has done some scripted movies as well.
I don't know what hers would be.
But that, you know, it doesn't always... I tend to think of it more from that perspective of a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if Alex Gibney has done a fiction film.
I don't think he has.
No. It's hard to make a fiction film where you're the star and the voiceover. Maybe that's why. Anyway. Do you want to start? Do you want to give your pick first?
All right. I will start. All right. For my first pick, I went with a movie that I'd actually hadn't seen yet and that I really liked a lot. Seymour: An Introduction, which is streaming on Netflix. Directed by Ethan Hawke. As a director, Ethan Hawke's career has consisted pretty much of two unmemorable indie dramas. He made 2001's Chelsea Walls, which is based on a Nicole Burdette play, and starred, among others, Hawke's then-wife Uma Thurman. And then there was 2006's The Hottest State, based on his own novel.
There was? Okay.
Yeah, there was.
That one I haven't even heard of.
You don't remember? Remember when he wrote a novel called The Hottest State?
And I must confess, I do not remember that.
Yes. Well, there is a reason we do not talk a lot about these movies. And then in 2014, Hawke turned to documentary for the first time and made a movie called Seymour, An Introduction. It's nothing to do with J.B. Salinger. It is instead a portrait of Seymour Bernstein, who abandoned an acclaimed career as a concert pianist at the age of 50 to teach instead. And it is, if I can say this without making it sound like a slight, I don't mean that. It is an extremely nice film. It feels
does
like
sound like a slight.
It cozying up to like Coco or something. It is the movie equivalent. It is a series of interviews and conversations with Bernstein and his friends, his students. It shows him at work with his piano students. And it becomes this kind of meditation on what it means to pursue your passion, to pursue your art, while also figuring out how to divorce that from the drive to also be famous, to be successful, to get rich. And it's also about stage fright, interestingly, which Hawke, who comes and goes in the film on occasion, mostly keeps out of it, which I think is a good choice. Mm-hmm. Hawke confesses to feeling. He confesses to, in doing theater work, having wrestled more and more with stage fright as his career has gone along. And Bernstein had a lot of trouble where, as his career as a concert pianist grew, he felt more and more stage fright as opposed to less. Hmm. And that, in a way, being like, I don't need to do this. That is not, like, the point of my art is not that it has to be done in front of people in order to be real. That I don't have to get acclaim in order for it to be real. I think there is something, like, extremely freeing about that. That it is just as genuine, more so, that, you know, your relationship with it. It's a movie that's extremely fond of this austere life that Bernstein has carved out for himself. We see at different times the like New York studio apartment he's lived in for decades. He has a sofa that he unfolds into a bed every night. The movie reminded me of Bill Cunningham, New York, which is another movie about like an almost monk-like pursuit of one's art. It is a very good movie. Or it also reminded me of Patterson, Jim Jarmusch's upcoming film, which is another one about artistic purity, really, about devotion to your craft without needing it to depend on outside acclaim. So I don't. It is a genuinely nice movie, and I think one in which you can feel Hawke's veneration for this man and for the kind of purity of his life, and for in some ways the like this pursuit of a type of life that I think in New York seems always in danger of fading. Mm-hmm. So that is Seymour, An Introduction, and it is on Netflix.
All right. I haven't seen that one. You said it's on Netflix,
so
I'm going to be adding that to my list after I give my pick, and you get to talk again. My first pick. So for mine, when I see that a fiction director has made a documentary, one of my first questions is always like, what makes them an expert on this subject? Which is probably why I like. And I tend to like when fiction directors make movies about movies, because that is something that they actually definitely know a lot about. And so one of my favorite movies about movies by a director of fiction movies is A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese Through American Movies. It's from 1995, and it's Martin Scorsese talking into the camera and narrating over clips from some of his favorite movies, movies he considers very important, very influential. It's almost 4 hours long. It's three parts, so it's really more of a miniseries than a film or a documentary, I suppose. It also, watching it this week for the first time in a decade, it actually made me think that it is one of the sort of proto video essays, sort of in the prehistory before YouTube and people making supercuts and stuff. This is sort of one of the earliest sort of steps towards that, because he's tracing all these different threads through Hollywood history and he's illustrating them with clips and personal anecdotes. And it really does feel like a really awesome video essay that just happens to be narrated and directed by Martin Scorsese. So you see him talking mostly the way it's structured about directors and how directors shape and influence their material and how they convey meanings to audiences. So he talks about the evolution of different genres in Hollywood, like the Western and the musical and the gangster film. And in one of my favorite sequences, he compares directors to smugglers, smuggling in these hidden meanings, these political commentaries, inside movies where you wouldn't expect them. Hacky studio pictures, tawdry exploitation films, that sort of thing. And the clips are fantastic. Scorsese knows a lot about these movies. His commentary is very smart and incisive because he's commenting on them not only as a film fan and as a guy who grew up watching these specific movies, but also as a director. So he can say, you know, in the case of a silent film or an early sound film that has camera movement at a time where, you know, there wasn't a lot, or the sort of prevailing wisdom is when sound was introduced, the camera stopped moving because microphones, and they were so delicate and sensitive and you couldn't move the camera anymore. So he'll show you a clip of an early sound film that has a lot of interesting camera movement that looks a little bit like the long take from Goodfellas, actually. It's inside like a bar and it's following this tray, kind of the same way the camera follows the table in Goodfellas, where they sort of break off from Ray Liotta and they're following the table through the Copacabana. So he'll talk about that and how difficult such a shot is, that it looks easy, but it's not. So he can provide that sort of commentary, which is great. And besides the fact that you get that insight, and it's very interesting, this is a great documentary to watch to discover other things to watch, because Scorsese's not just recommending Citizen Kane and Casablanca. He's doing much more the unsung filmmakers, the B pictures of the classical Hollywood era that don't get as much attention. You know, if you're a real hardcore cinephile, you'll know them. But if you're not, then you won't. And when I watched it for the first time, these were filmmakers maybe I'd heard of, I'd never seen anything by, or I hadn't heard of them at all. These are directors like Delmer Daves and Frank Borzage and Jock Turner, you know, that... When I watched this documentary for the first time in grad school, it was like a supplement to my actual education, because it led me to all these other great films. And I'm sure if you haven't seen this documentary and you're looking for more classical Hollywood movies to watch, you will get even more out of this. So that is A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese Through American Movies. That's a very long title. And it's sort of hard to track down right now. You can find it on YouTube. Sort of unofficially. I'm not telling you to watch it on YouTube, although the way that it's, again, like little separate video essays, it kind of works pretty well in that format. But actually, when Filmstruck, the new streaming service from Turner Classic Movies and Criterion, when they launch, which is now TBD next month, as I think the last we've heard, this is actually one of the titles they will have available. So you'll be able to watch it there. And it is really, really, really good. So there you go. Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese Through American Movies. Long title.
All right. Well, before I give my next pick, I wanted to say, I looked this up in
yes.
between. Barbara Kopple directed Havoc. Do you remember Havoc with Anne Hathaway and Phillips?
Oh, yes.
It was her first scripted film, and I think maybe her only scripted
film. Yeah.
And also, while we're here, we didn't give a shout out to him, but it may be one of the most obvious filmmakers who has been successful both in fiction film and in nonfiction, who deserves a mention, is Spike Lee.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, and then, I thought about him, but again, that was another one where I felt like he's almost made, at this point, he's made quite a few documentaries. I didn't know if that was maybe cheating a little bit.
Right, especially when, like, some ways, his recent documentary work has gotten more acclaim than his scripted films have.
Yeah, but there are some of his are available, because I was looking at him as a potential candidate. I think, is it Four Little Girls is available on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. You can watch that there.
Yeah, and should. He's,
yes.
He's a very good documentary.
He is a good documentarian.
So for my second pick, I went with And Everything Is Going Fine, which is available for rent. And I think might also be on Sundance Now Doc Club, if anyone has Sundance Now Doc Club. You know, for all of his experimentation with form and with the boundaries between fiction and nonfiction and casting people whose real identities ping off of these characters they're playing, Steven Soderbergh hasn't actually directed many projects that could be called documentaries. He did a 1985 concert doc for the band Yes, right at the beginning of his career. He did a companion,
what a great piece of trivia.
Right? He did a companion short doc for the 1970 film End of the Road when he was helping kind of like bring it back to be rediscovered.
Doesn't count.
And he made Grey's Anatomy,
right,
the fourth of the four feature recordings made of Spalding Gray's performances of his own monologues. Mm-hmm. Spalding Gray is an actor and a performer who became best known for these sprawling, discursive, funny, intimate, dramatized personal stories that were always done sitting at a desk on stage, sometimes with a few props. Gray died of an apparent suicide in 2004. And in 2010, Soderbergh made what is, in a way, the closest thing he has to a traditional documentary feature, and it is not traditional at all. It is a film made up entirely of archival footage from Gray's performances and from interviews he did. And the result is, I say this genuinely, it's extraordinary. He puts this material together in chronological order so that, in effect, Gray tells the story of his own life, including how he came to the format that's become his life work, his life's work, and his process. He talks about his parents, his home life, his mother's suicide, which casts a shadow over the whole film. He talks about his longtime relationship with a girlfriend, and his anxiety, the relationship he starts with eventually the woman he ends up marrying and having children with, that first child, and how he was so afraid that he didn't actually meet that first child until the boy was 8 months old. I think he's a teenager now, or maybe slightly older, but he composes the music for the movie Everything Is Going Fine. And I think one of the things, beyond just like how deft and how delicately done an editing job this is, in the way you have to, movies like this, in which you're using archival footage as your raw material and nothing else, no other interviews, nothing that was done outside of that. You know, it's I think that it just shows a touch of this master filmmaker, and particularly in the fact that you see Gray in different points, you know, older at one moment and gray maned, and then suddenly he's a younger man again, and then he's much older, and he's just been through a terrible car accident that really like shapes the last part of his life, and then he's you know, back towards the start of his career. It's I think something really magical about the way it is able to ping pong through his life using his own words. It is almost like summoning work, new work from what is existing. It's a great movie. And I think, you know, you don't necessarily need to be familiar with Spalding Gray's work to see it, though seeing it, I think, makes you want to explore it. And if it is something you want to explore, there are four, as I said, four films made of four of his monologues, and they all have, I think, pretty major filmmakers behind them. I think Nick Broomfield did one of them as well. But that is Everything Is Going Fine. Steven Soderbergh directed it. It's available for rent and definitely worth a look.
Okay. My last pick is one I actually mentioned recently on the show as an 8-ball pick, but this kind of gives me an opportunity to talk about it a little bit more and to think about it in a different way, in a different context, as a documentary by a director who makes fiction movies. The director is Ron Howard, and the film is the also unwieldily titled The Beatles 8 Days a Week, The Touring Years. Apparently, when fiction filmmakers make documentaries, they give them extraordinarily long titles.
Just terrible titles.
Yeah, really. Terrible titles.
Like, why do you need, like, how many colons and dashes do you need?
Yeah, I don't know. This is a terrible title, but it's a good movie, and it's a new film with new interviews from the surviving Beatles, and also some surprising talking heads, including Malcolm Gladwell, and this one really shocked my socks off, Sigourney Weaver is a talking head in this documentary, talking about being a young Beatlemaniac, going to see the Beatles as a teenager, and craziest of all, Allison, there is footage of teenage Sigourney Weaver, like, crying and screaming over John Lennon. It's pretty incredible.
That's
to
amazing.
See. Yeah, that alone blew my mind and kind of justifies the existence of this documentary. There have been, of course, other documentaries about the Beatles. There was the Beatles Anthology series, which was such a huge thing on television when we were in high school. That's now a long time ago, unfortunately. As the title suggests, in this case, This focuses on their early years as they honed their sound, came to America, and basically, you know, systematically changed the entire world. So I rewatched some of this yesterday, trying to discern, because of our topic, what makes this a Ron Howard movie. Ron Howard is a man who has made, I think, some very good films. He's won Oscars, but not really known for being a man of a particular or distinctive filmmaking style, I would say. Would you disagree, Allison?
No, I mean, I feel like he's your like example of a studio craftsman who does perfectly fine work, some better, some worse.
Right. If he had been working in the 40s and 50s, I'm not sure he would have been one of Scorsese's people that he would single out for having smuggled in lots of bold and exciting messages in A Personal Journey Through American Movies. To Ron Howard's credit, though, I think he does actually do something kind of interesting with this documentary in terms of structure. Instead of just being, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, it does proceed sort of chronologically a little bit, but it also pinballs around in time. So they'll be on tour, the Beatles are on tour, they're going to the studio, and then the movie will kind of pause and talk about George Martin and go back and talk about his life and what he did and how he came to be a producer with them. And a reporter who followed the Beatles on one of their tours of America mentions that his mother died the year that he was on tour with the Beatles, and that both John and Paul comforted him. And then that kind of segues into a section where Paul talks about his mother dying when he was young, and that John's mother died young, and that... And I like that. I like the way the movie kind of flows in and out of memories, the way people kind of do when they talk about their own lives and they tell stories. You might be telling a story and it reminds you of something else, and that reminds you of something else. And so I give credit to Ron Howard here for, I don't know if that's something that makes it a distinctively Ron Howard movie, but it felt like something to me as a viewer that seemed like a touch from fiction, maybe a little bit, that you would arrange this information not to suit the information, but to suit the storytelling, to make it a more sort of engrossing and a narrative that flows more smoothly, or that just does it in a way that, instead of telling all the sort of dry details of when we were kids and when we did this and then we did that, that to do it where you sort of intersperse the best footage, which is of the Beatles in action, with some of these other little details that fill out the biography. And, of course, like Ron Howard's Dan Brown trilogy, this ends with Tom Hanks saving the world from a historical conspiracy. Okay, maybe not. But this does have excellent archival footage of the Beatles in the studio, on the road, and it does give a pretty good sense also of the time they lived in. If I ever personally knew that the Beatles helped desegregate music venues in the South by refusing to play in segregated venues, I had forgotten it, but they did, and that's to their credit. So, yeah, I mean, you were saying for your pick, maybe this is not necessarily something Spalding Gray fan, like you don't have to be a Spalding Gray fan. I'm not sure that you have to be a Beatles fan here, but it probably, again, would like lead you to discover some of their other works. Probably people are a little more familiar with the Beatles and Spalding Gray, but I think the description still apt. So that is the very poorly titled, but very well made, The Beatles 8 Days a Week, The Touring Years, available on Hulu for streaming. Before we talk about some new movies, let's plug once again our live show in Chicago, Friday, November 18th, Shuba's Lincoln Hall. Film Spotting SVU is coming. We are opening for Film Spotting. It's a Film Spotting and Film Spotting SVU double bill.
Please come see us.
Our first show in Chicago, only our second live show ever.
Yes.
We will be there. We've got all our hotels. Airfare is booked. It is happening.
It is definitely happening.
Tickets have been sold.
Show up on that stage. By golly.
Tickets have been sold, but there are still tickets available. You can find more information at by looking up the Chicago Podcast Festival, which the show is a part of, or you can go to Shuba's Lincoln Hall's website, which is lh-st.com. And we wanted to throw this out there. We are still sort of, you know, we could just do a regular show, something like that, but we're also, you know, this is a special occasion, and so we want to make it special, so we're throwing this out there. If people have ideas, we'd mostly want to hear from people who are actually coming, but, you know, if you just want to suggest something, that's fine, too. Send us emails. SVU at filmspottingsvu.com is our email address, as always. We're curious, what would you want to see Film Spotting SVU Live do? you know, if you're thinking outside the box, the obvious stuff we could do. But if you have a good idea for something,
yeah,
let us hear about it. Something bold, something exciting.
Yeah, we want your wildest ideas.
Right. They're
Don't
not going to happen. They're not going to happen. We're not going to do them, but we want to hear about them.
You know, surprise us.
We did also ask this on Twitter. We've already had a couple of ideas that we liked a lot that we're already sort of putting into the basket of deplorable ideas that we're batting around. And this was an idea that I had that we're going to throw out there. Not guaranteed we're going to do it, but we'll see what the response we get was. Here was my idea. We thought it might be fun for the people who actually attend to essentially play the role, as Allison put it when I pitched this to her, of Netflix algorithm, but for all of the internet. So here's how this would work. If you are coming to the show, you can email us. Again, the email address is svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And how do you think this would work in terms of their, what should they send us? Like five favorite movies?
Yeah, I think send us 5 to 10, let's say. 5 to 10 favorite
beloved movies. Beloved movies. And how about this?
Yes.
Give us a suggestion of a genre.
Yes.
That makes it easier. And we will give you a personalized recommendation that we will present at the show.
And we will explain our thinking.
Yes.
When try getting that from Netflix.
That's right. And but it might be from Netflix. It might be from any streaming service.
I'm just saying, we're going to explain our thinking.
Right.
We're
we won't just be like,
you,
bzz, 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 you would like.
You have seen this Martin Scorsese
Jessica
movie.
Jones.
Right. You might like Jessica Jones.
Right.
You watched Seinfeld. You might like Jessica Jones.
Right. Exactly. Yes. It'll be more. We will put some thought into it. We will do our best to give you a personalized recommendation. So that's an idea. If you're coming to the show, send us an email, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. It'd be really funny if we get like 200 recommendations that we have to figure out. If that happens, we might have to...
We'll figure that out.
Right.
If we can't
read them all at the show,
we will send them out.
We will email them. Yes, we will follow through.
Also, like if you are going to be at the show, we will be around afterwards. Please come up and say hi. We, you know, would love to hear
from
you.
We'll be heckling, I assume, Film Spotting Original Recipe during their show.
We'll be, you know... like Muppets up in the corner. Ooh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on now to some recent releases in the segment that has a name almost as long and convoluted as Martin Scorsese's American Journey Through American Cinema, personal story or whatever it is. What should we start with? Should we start with the movie that we both seen, I guess? That's probably the best way to go.
What is the movie? Oh, yes. Yes, let's do that.
Because that's the really good movie that people
really
should really
movie.
Seek out.
It is not in wide release. Usually we stick to wide release, but this one is definitely worth a mention. It is Moonlight, Barry Jenkins' long-awaited second movie that is rapidly becoming one of the most acclaimed, really the one, of, like, I'd say right now, the most acclaimed movie of the year.
Yeah, it's certainly in the top five,
yes,
for sure.
I think very justifiably. It's just such a good movie. It's really a gorgeously done coming-of-age story over three periods in its main character's life. One thing I will say about this movie that I think is getting overlooked in all of how it's being heralded is so important and so, you know, it's a kind of sexy and romantic movie in addition to being heartbreaking.
Yeah.
In between the kind of terrible experiences and some great ones that its main character goes through, it is basically this love story. And I think, especially in the final third, it is like there's a scene of dialogue that is just so warm and great. And I think that's a quality that is getting kind of undersold in all of the praise for this movie.
I think you're right. And it's funny, I was talking with someone who had seen it and they said, oh, it was wonderful, but it was so depressing. And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's not the chipperest movie I've ever seen, but I kind of agree with you that last sequence really, it brings the mood up significantly. I mean, there is definitely some sadness in that last sequence too, but... there's something
it
very
ends on an up note.
Yes.
Yes.
Not to spoil anything, but this is not, you're not going to walk out of the movie despairing for humanity any more than you did when you walked into the theater because it's 2016 and that's all we're doing right now. I completely agree about this movie. It is beautiful. It is, I mean, in terms of my favorite movies of the year, it certainly has some of the best performances of the year. The three men who play the main character at these three different points of his life. I guess really a boy and a teenager and a man, they give such incredible performances that are so rich and it's a character
like a through line.
Yes. And it's a character too who sometimes doesn't reveal his feelings. That's part of what makes this character you know, him is he keeps to himself. He keeps his feelings to himself. So playing that is not easy. And the way that these guys do it is just absolutely remarkable. So it's a really well written film with great dialogue, with great performances. So that to me is what it is why you want to see it most of all, is really like there are some beautiful, incredibly moving performances that will just make you weep. And I think that the reason that why somebody might feel kind of devastated by it is just how good the acting is in this movie.
Yeah, it is, though. It is like a very intimate and like very emotional movie. And I think that, yeah, so much of like kind of, I think, the keywords that get thrown around with black masculinity and queer identity and all of these other things, which are absolutely applicable.
It's all there.
But that this is it's not an abstract movie in any way.
No.
Like, it is very intimate. It is very immediate.
No, you don't have to be a black to get this movie. You don't have to be gay to get this movie. I mean, I could relate to a lot of things in this movie, and I thought it was absolutely beautiful and so moving. So, and it builds. See, that's the other thing. Like, it starts a little slowly and you're waiting and then it starts to sort of take you along. And by the end of it, it is, even though it's like two people sitting in a diner, it's like one of the most suspenseful scenes of the year. And you're just so like on the edge of your seat waiting to see what happens with these two characters. It's really great. So go see Moonlight when it's playing by you.
Yeah, it's slowly kind of expanding around the country, so it should make its way near you, hopefully, knock on wood,
yes.
Soonish. And it's worth seeing it.
I have a feeling it's going to make its way around for sure. Okay, so very quickly now, two other movies, one that I have seen, one that Allison has seen. I feel like it's very...
It's like actually a perfect divide also of like a Matt movie and an Allison movie.
Yeah. You want me to go with first with mine? Mine is Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. Spoiler alert. He goes back, guys. He goes back. He shouldn't have gone back, but he went back. This is the second Jack Reacher film based on one of the novels by Lee Child about this character who's basically like, you know, Sanjuro or the Man with No Name, this wandering hero figure who rights wrongs in America in this case. And in this film, he shows up sort of for like a date with the woman who replaced him as the head of this military police unit, who's played by Kobe Smulders. And she's in jail. She's been jailed for espionage. And he, of course, breaks her out and they go on the lam and they prove her innocence. And, you know, it's all the sorts of things that you would expect from a Jack Reacher film with Tom Cruise. I was very surprised because I wrote my review before it came out, and then my review goes up, and I see that, like, this movie, I'm going to look up what it has on Rotten Tomatoes, but a lot of the reviews were pretty negative. It has a 40%. Nah, it's not a masterpiece, this movie, but to me it was like, this is exactly what I wanted from Jack Reacher. Like, Tom Cruise runs a lot. He looks very sternly at people. At one point, he, like, somehow manages to outsmart a guy and get him imprisoned while wearing handcuffs. In one scene, he says to a guy, "I'm going to break your legs. I'm going to break your arms. I'm going to break your neck." And then he does it in that order. Like, what more do you want from Jack Reacher Never Go Back than all of that? Like, I just felt like it was a very solid Jack Reacher movie that delivered the Jack Reacher Tom Cruise experience that I wanted. So sort of mystified that people didn't like it as much. I thought it was, you know, pretty much almost on par with the previous film. So if you like the first one, I think you'll probably enjoy this one as well. Jack Reacher, Never Go Back.
All right. And the movie I will talk about is The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook's,
which I want to see. Let's just say, movie too, I think.
Course,
I would enjoy
course,
it. I
sure.
love Park Chan-wook, and I want to see it.
You know that I watch my Tom
when
Cruise
movies
on
When this movie is on cable,
too.
You will watch
I
it.
I absolutely... Well, I tried to watch the other Jack Reacher movie, and I will say, I just did not understand what Jack Reacher's thing was.
He's like, Tom Cruise. He's the man with no name.
I just need like a little bit more shtick is what I need, I guess, than, oh, he shows up and fixes things. Anyway, The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook's most recent movie... this is the official genre, according to Wikipedia, is erotic psychological thriller, which I think is fairly accurate. It is adapted, of all things, from a novel set in Victorian England, transferred over to Korea, occupied Korea, and is mostly set in this fantastic estate that is like half Japanese style architecture and half like British architecture, and is all about a maid who is hired to kind of take care of and arrange, basically like help, arrange this con to help a con man who's coming in to marry this heiress. And then there's a turn in the middle in which the point of view flips to another character, and suddenly you have to reevaluate everything that's come before. It is so gorgeously directed. You know, I think that sometimes Park Chan-wook is I feel like he loses control of the movie towards the end a lot of the time of his films. Like, he has such talent, just like film, like raw filmmaking talent that just like bursts out. And then it's almost like he gets bored, I think, or like towards the end of the movie. And that is not the case in this movie. I will say it is in some ways, it is a story about two women who kind of are like trapped by male gaze that kind of ironically has some of the most male gazey sex scenes I think I can ever think of. Yeah. Like, they are both hot and like excessive in ways that,
and you think this movie isn't for me, come on,
there Allison. You go. In ways that I guess you kind of expect of this filmmaker. You know, he's never been one to deny himself anything, but it is like such a smart, like twisty, gorgeously made movie. You kind of want to live in it, even when it has disturbing elements. It's a lot of fun. It's in addition to just being so wonderfully made. That's The Handmaiden, which is also in limited release, I think, right now, but should be making its way around the movie or around the nation soon.
Yeah,
because you know who doesn't like an erotic psychological thriller?
I love them. I was already sold, but when you described it as an erotic thriller, now I'm really keen to see it. All right, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball, where we wrap things up with some new releases. New to streaming, three of them, and then we give you some listener recommendations, two of those, and then we give you one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Allison, would you like me to go first, since you just gave your recommendation of The Handmaiden?
Why don't you go first, Matt?
Okay.
Well, then give me three new releases.
All right. First up on Netflix is Mascots, the new film and the first mockumentary in over a decade from Christopher Guest, the director of Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show. As the title suggests, it's about the world of sports mascots and specifically a competition amongst a bunch of them to determine who is the best in the world. The cast of Mascots includes Parker Posey, Zach Woods, Chris O'Dowd as The Fist, this angry hockey hooligan mascot who's like a big fist. I saw this movie at TIFF. I laughed quite a bit. I didn't love the actual competition, which seemed very ridiculous to me. Like, no one would do these dumb routines. And then when the movie ended, out of curiosity, I looked online before I wrote my review and said, this is stupid, no one would ever do this. And then found that actually this is very accurate to what these mascot competitions look like. So as stupid as I thought it was fairly realistic. So maybe I didn't even give it enough credit when I saw it the first time. That is Mascots. It is available on Netflix. Next up also on Netflix is Big Eyes, the 2014 biopic from Tim Burton about the life of artist Margaret Keane, who painted these very Tim Burton-esque paintings of children with big eyes. But who had all the credit for her work stolen by her husband, Walter, until she sued him. Amy Adams is the star. She gives a really good performance as Margaret Keane. And Christoph Waltz, well, he's very Christoph Waltz-y as the husband, Walter Keane. And this is far and away my favorite Tim Burton movie I think he's made maybe this century. I mean, I really like this movie, and I haven't liked a lot of Tim Burton's work lately. It's a great story, and the way he shoots it is pretty good. I like the way that he's always kind of sticking Amy Adams in corners, up against walls. You always feel Christoph Waltz looming over her, controlling her, threatening her. Even when he's doing that Christoph Waltz thing of smiling and laughing and, I'm Christoph Waltz. And, you know, it's the story of a wife who is being sort of controlled by this husband and a society that kind of can't even conceive that a woman could make this artwork. So it's maybe even more timely now than it was just a few years ago when it was made. So that is Big Eyes on Netflix. And finally, on Amazon Prime, I've got Slapshot, the 1977 sports comedy directed by George Roy Hill and starring Paul Newman as Reggie Dunlop, the player coach of the hapless Charleston Chiefs. It's a pretty standard worst-to-first sports movie story, but what elevates it is Newman's great performance in the leading role and the fact that the Chiefs are a minor league hockey team. So the whole film has this kind of sad, blue-collar, broke-ass vibe to it that's really great. and it cuts all of the comedy with this edge of sadness and despair. It's definitely one of my favorite sports movies. It is Slapshot, available on Amazon Prime.
All right, how about two listener recommendations?
All right, first up from Phil Olson, who writes, "Hey guys, it's only on Cinemax Go, so I don't know if it counts." It counts, Phil. But I just saw Speed Racer for the first time, and I was not prepared for how amazing it is. If you had any doubts about the auteurness of the Wachowskis, this should put that to rest. I don't think anyone else could have made this movie. The way it's edited, uses flashbacks and flash forwards, the crazy visual style, the zany childlike tone, and the awesome action all blended together are totally unique. The best description of this movie I've heard is that it is like a Skittles-induced seizure, but in a good way. If you can go into it with an open mind, it's amazing. Keep up the great work. That was from Phil, and that's for Speed Racer on Cinemax Go, which is an appropriate name of a streaming service for Speed Racer, actually. I did not particularly enjoy Speed Racer when it came out.
You're wrong. It's a great movie.
I have not revisited it, but it seems to be a film that is rapidly accruing a very intense cult following.
I like it.
Yes.
Yes.
You're not the only one. Phil likes it too. But a lot of people like it. Maybe not a lot, but more and more people seem to be liking it. So at some point, I'm going to have to go back.
I also like Jupiter Ascending.
I like Jupiter Ascending too.
Okay, good.
Not.
Yeah.
It's okay.
We'll go on to the next one.
We don't need to relitigate Jupiter Ascending, but maybe we will. Maybe that's what we'll do at our live show.
That's all.
Just for you, Jupiter Ascending. And we'll cosplay in Jupiter Ascending.
Absolutely.
It'll be great. All right. Our next recommendation comes from Matt P. in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And Matt writes, "Okay. On episode 122, listener George L. recommended Ark, along with other time travel movies. He mentioned Predestination and the one I love. To those suggestions, I would add Synchronicity, I Love Me Some Michael Ironside, Time Lapse, and the miniseries Ascension. There's a lot of new, interesting time travel films that have been added since you last covered this topic. So if you're looking for a listener's choice recommendation and aren't averse to sequels, well, that's just a thought. Maybe do another episode about time travel. Time Travel Part Deux. Thanks for the great show. I just got done with High Rise, The Invitation, and A Pigeon Sat on the Branch. All recommendations from your team. Looking forward to what you review next." That's from Matt P. in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Thank you, Matt. I like the idea that this one time travel episode or this one recommendation of a time travel movie now keeps reoccurring as if we were caught in some kind of time travel loop. I hope we are recommending time travel movies based on this one email till the end of time or till the end of the time travel loop. Or now my head hurts. I don't know. Anyway, thank you for that email, Matt.
All right. How about one from your My List?
You gave me number two. And number two on my list right now is Luke Cage, the latest Netflix Marvel series. The plot description is a hoodie-wearing unbreakable ex-con fights to clear his name and save his neighborhood. He wasn't looking for a fight, but the people needed a hero. I have yet to watch Luke Cage. I've heard mixed things about this Netflix series, and as our listeners know, I'm a huge fan of Netflix's Marvel series in particular, and I like them, and I don't think they're too long or boring at all.
Have pacing problems.
I love them all, so I'm going to get to this one very soon, and I haven't heard any of those complaints about Luke Cage either, but I do like the guy who plays Luke Cage. He was really good in Jessica Jones, so... You know, it's on here. I've got it on the list. I'm sure I will at least sample it. I'll watch the first episode. We will see how many episodes I get through. I guess when I actually do watch it, I can report back and say, okay, I've actually watched it, or I gave up after one episode or five episodes or whatever it may be. Luke Cage on Netflix. All right, Allison, are you ready with your picks?
I am ready.
Okay, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, first up, new to Amazon Prime is Love and Friendship. Truly one of the most enjoyable, just like purely enjoyable movies of the year. Whit Stillman, a great chronicler of the absurdities of New York's would-be aristocracy, turns out to be an excellent match for Jane Austen, who did the same with the English would-be aristocracy. This movie is adapted from Austen's Lady Susan, with a truly excellent Kate Beckinsale as Lady Susan Vernon, a young widow with an impressive ruthlessness and a hilarious ruthlessness in terms of imposing on the hospitality of others, taking advantage of people, and scheming for advantageous marriages for herself and her daughter. Lots of great supporting performances, but I wanted to particularly give a shout out to Tom Bennett as this outstanding doofus of a bachelor who has a wonderful scene involving peas that you will never forget. Love and Friendship is new on Amazon Prime. New to Netflix is Black Mirror. We have talked about this in a previous episode, SVU number 76, if you want to hear us go over the first six episodes. This is technically season three, I guess. Netflix is making 12 new episodes. They've just dropped six new ones. It practically doubles the existing number of episodes that are out there already. I will say they're not quite as good as the first six, though there's one that I flat out love, Nosedive, starring Bryce Dallas Howard, directed by Joe Wright of Atonement, and set in a world in which everyone gives each other five-star ratings for every interaction, including small talk, buying coffee, etc. And it's one of the grimmest looks at a Pinterest perfect world I think you can imagine. All the new episodes are worth checking out. Black Mirror, new episodes on Netflix. And finally, new to Amazon Prime is The Fitz, Anna Rose Holmer's directorial debut, which has been one of the most quietly acclaimed of the year. It's kind of a fable involving a community center in which girls kind of learn dance and boys mostly do boxing. And the pre-adolescent heroine, played by the magnificently named Royalty Hightower, moves in between these worlds. But they come to seem like having to kind of go towards the one in which you've been assigned comes to seem like this start of adulthood. And then there is this whole thing in which maybe illness or maybe group hysteria strikes the girls and they start having fits. I didn't love this movie as much as some other people did, but I do think it is fantastically well made in just like the cinematography choices and in the performances. It is very spooky, and it kind of marries this big idea with this very small story of coming of age in a way that I think is certainly interesting. So that is The Fitz, and it is on Amazon Prime.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, we got an epic email from our longtime listener, Joe in Astoria. I trimmed it down a bit, Joe. I hope that I I'm doing justice to your
words. Justice to his vision.
But he's recommending Return to Oz. Joe writes, I'm writing to give an enthusiastic recommendation to Walter Murch's undersung modern classic, Return to Oz, which is available for rent. Watching this again in my 30s was a transcendent experience for reasons that go way beyond just nostalgia. While some of the scarier elements of the film did stick with me, particularly the Wheelers and the headless princess who keeps a cabinet of living woman's heads to switch between, what I loved most about it as a kid was the immersive, imaginative world it created and the bond Dorothy shares with the memorable and entertaining new friends she meets in Oz. I've read some blog posts reappraising this film online, and most of them focus on the darker and weirder elements of it, which definitely are a big part of what is great and memorable about the movie. But they tend to miss the underlying sweetness Dorothy shares with her fun new group of friends, and the earnestness with which she, perfectly played by a young Fruza Balk, goes through her journey, not to mention all the good humor. I teared up when she says goodbye to the best group of friends anyone has ever had at the end of the film, surprised at how much it affected me. She's not just saying goodbye to her friends, she's saying goodbye to this world of imagination, a stronger person now who has to return to the more drab real world and incoming adulthood. I'm not saying this to pretend Return to Oz isn't a darker film at times, but darker elements often play a role in some of the best kids' stories. Kids in these stories are made to feel alone and in danger in a scary world and have to learn to shoulder that responsibility themselves. Legendary in the fields of editing and sound, this was the only film Walter Murch directed, and he did a beautiful job. This is a film that reminds you what it is to be young, when your imagination can feel so much bigger than the world you live in. Some of it can be scary, and you might feel alone, but you know that what you're experiencing is true, even when no one believes you. This is a great film. And that was a great email. Thank you, Joe. It was really something else. I was really impressed by it. And second recommendation, short and sweet from Lindsay, who writes, have you seen Peaky Blinders on Netflix? Cillian Murphy is bewitching. So thank you for that, Lindsay.
All right, and how about one film on my list?
You gave me number 11. It is a movie we've talked about before. I believe we even got a listener recommendation for it. Kill Zone 2.
Yeah.
This is the description. When undercover officer Kit is taken prisoner by the syndicate, he befriends his keeper and discovers an organ trafficking ring.
Yeah.
Stars Wu Jing as a Hong Kong cop and the great Tony Jaa as the Thai prison guard he defends, who I assume does some punching and kicking. Yes. Someday I will see this movie. I have heard so much about it.
It's pretty awesome.
Yes.
Yes. It's, I think if you had given me like number 3 on my list, it would be on there. I haven't taken it off yet. It is good. All right. Let's get to our listener's choice options for our next episode. Interesting, eclectic bunch as usual. I have the first one. It is The Neon Demon, which will be available on Amazon Prime starting on November 3rd. This is the new film from Nicholas Winding Refn. The plot follows an aspiring model in Los Angeles whose beauty and youth generate intense fascination and jealousy within the industry. Supporting roles are played by Jenna Malone, Bella Heathcote, Abby Lee, Carl Glusman, Christina Hendricks, and Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves is in this film as well. It is an interesting movie. I've already seen it. Allison has already seen
it.
I'm not sure that we're both, either of us, huge fans of the movie, but there's a lot to talk about.
There's a lot.
It would provoke a rich discussion, I am sure, and it would give us a pretty good excuse to look at this movie again and think about it some more, because there, like I already said, there's a lot going on there. There's a lot to chew over, a lot to think about. We could do movies like movies about modeling, the modeling world.
Yeah.
We could do movies about Los Angeles. I'm not sure if we've done that as a subject before. We could do Refn. We could do the Fanning dynasty.
That's an interesting idea. Stars
Elle Fanning, and Dakota is still going strong as well. Is there another Fanning? Is there a third Fanning? Bippy Fanning?
Bippy?
What, Bippy Fanning? I don't know.
Yeah, Harpo Fanning.
The lesser Fanning Bippy?
I not that I know of,
okay.
But who knows what they have, you know, who they've been keeping.
Well, when we get an angry email from Bippy Fanning, bippy.fanning@gmail.com, saying, how could you forget me? You'll have to apologize personally.
Consider it done.
That's option one, The Neon Demon, available on Amazon Prime on November 3rd.
All right, and keeping with this kind of unofficial theme of formidable young women, our second option is The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, which is, according to all reports, going to be added to Amazon Prime on November 1st. We can never 100% guarantee when we're doing ones in the future like that they will turn up. But this is from the official email they send out. So it's supposed to be there. And this is the 1976 film that is, I think, kind of a cult favorite, starring Jodie Foster, young Jodie Foster, as a 13-year-old girl who is living by herself in a small town in Maine while her father never seems to show up and all of the villagers try and figure out what happened to him. And there's murder, there's romance, there's all kinds of disturbing stuff. It is a movie that I've heard so much about and never gotten to see. There's a young Martin Sheen in it as well. And I, you know, I think that even like an opportunity to do a Jodie Foster podcast would be good.
Yeah.
But yeah, mostly I just want to watch this movie. I've heard a lot about it. I think it has kind of accrued a cult following over the years, and to have it finally on streaming is exciting. So that's The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane. That will be on Amazon Prime, and that is your second option.
Our third option, I guess our other theme here is Amazon Prime, because our third option is on Amazon Prime as well. So no one's going to accuse us of giving you the Netflix pick that automatically wins. There shall be no Netflix winner this time, because our third option is also going to be, or I guess is already available on Amazon Prime. Allison's already mentioned it. It is The Fitz, directed by Anna Rose Holmer. First film from this director, played at Venice and Sundance. The plot description one more time. While training at the gym, 11-year-old tomboy Tony becomes entranced with a dance troupe. As she struggles to fit in, she finds herself caught up in danger as the group begins to suffer from fainting spells and other violent fits. And unlike Allison, I haven't seen this one yet. And I know she said she wasn't the hugest fan, but I've been hearing nothing but great things about it. Now I have to see it before the end of the year. So we are approaching that time of year where we have to start catching up with all the things we've missed. And this is definitely one that's on my personal list of movies that I missed I blame the baby, and so I'm really looking forward to catching up with it. I'll be seeing this one either way. It was especially exciting to see it on Amazon Prime because now I could catch up with it. So that is option number three, The Fitz, available on Amazon Prime.
Okay, which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Units? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or, and this is always much easier, just enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, October 31st, happy Halloween, at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, which is at FilmSpottingSVU, as well as on our Facebook, at FilmSpottingSVU there. And please give us a like if you have the inclination.
Please like us. Please clap.
Exactly. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which will come out around Tuesday, November 8th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations, film and TV, and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, though, follow us on Twitter, at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and follow the show at Film Spotting SVU, where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and where we share lots more streaming suggestions, both from SVU listeners and from both of us, but mostly Allison, although I pitch in from time to time as well. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.